You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the welcome to the Guidepost. Glad you guys could join us for the podcast. We have a what I would call a star-studded panel here. I'm looking at everyone on a video screen, so I'm just going to go left to right, top to bottom. We have Captain Ray Jarvis on. We got Blaine Chocolate, the one and only. We got Mike Hogan from Hoagie Lures. We got Jake Hardy on as well. And we're going to talk about striped bass today. And the reason why we're going to talk about striped bass is because we're seeing a lot of stuff out on social media and kind of all over the place that really isn't being honest about what the fishery is right now. And we're going to get into all of it. But I'm going to read y'all a social post that was sent to me the other day. And there were a lot of comments about it, but this is from a conservation organization. And it says, from Cape Cod to Maine, striped bass are running again, and the fishing has been nothing short of incredible. The stripers are largely in New England for one reason. They're following large migratory schools of bait fish known as menhaden, parenthetical, also called bunker, that they depend on for food. Besides sport fish, recreational and commercial fishermen, including lobstermen, also rely heavily on menhaden for bait. But 3/4 of the commercial Atlantic harvest quota for menhaden is still allocated to one state, Virginia, where the majority of the catch doesn't supply the bait industry, but instead a single foreign-owned industrial company that reduces menhaden into fish meal and oil. It's time for a change. So what you have here is an organization that is trying to fundraise off menhaden for menhaden and blaming the decline of stripers on the reduction fishery in Virginia. And they're also saying that the striper fishing is incredible. And they're also saying that the stripers are following menhaden. And that's their primary source of food. So I have two guys on here from Cape Cod, one guy on here who was from Long Island, from the Massachusetts area, lived in Long Island for a while, surf fished there fanatically, and recently moved up to Maine and is surf fishing there fanatically. So again, two Cape Cod, two Chesapeake Bay, one Long Island and Maine. And I will say, I know Jake either sends us texts at 1:30 in the morning when he's probably driving to catch the tide that he wants to fish, or, and I hope I didn't give too much away, Jake, or sometime around 11 a.m. Those are Jake's peak hours during the striper, you know, the striper moons coming up. But I'm not going to tease Jake too much, but let's take this piece by piece, guys. Is striper fishing incredible right now?
Define incredible. For me, that's my opening thought, right? Because if you're measuring by the ability to go out and catch a few big fish, you know, in a short period of time for a short window, theoretically, you could maybe argue that it's incredible, but if you're talking about the masses all at once, that's a larger question for me anyway. And, I think there's a lot of weird signals in the program. I sort of jumped the gun there, but I don't think it's incredible. At the same time, there's some really good days happening real time.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
And next, Ray, you want to? Or yeah, Brian and Blaine, then Jake.
I would agree with Mike there a little bit. I mean, to define the fishery as incredible is I don't know, short-sighted in a way, because if you think this is an incredible fishery, obviously we're not around in the early 2000s when you could go out, hit a number of spots and catch fish at all of those spots, not just these little peak windows where you're running into schools of fish, which right now happen to be primarily large fish. You know, when we see quote unquote incredible fishing right now, you're running into, at least this time of year, big schools of fish that are migrating up the coast. Definitely not chasing menhaden. I can tell you that because we haven't had a good push of them up here in years. They're generally on squid, sand eels. We've got more mackerel around nowadays than we ever had down on my side of Massachusetts. But, you know, to define the fishery as incredible is very far off. You know, it's definitely not representative of the fishery that I grew up in the early 2000s when the fishing was pretty incredible. You could bounce around with the tide and find fish at each and every spot predictably.
Blaine, nobody's going to believe us because we're fixing to talk about when the bay was incredible. So you were on the cover. I just want to frame this, y'all. Blaine was on the cover of Fly Fisherman magazine with a striper that he caught somewhere in the Chesapeake Bay, somewhere in the state of Virginia, sometime during the spawning run. How big was that? I don't think you measured it. How big do you think that fish was?
I mean, it was a bucket list striper for me, for sure. You know, it's one of those that, you know, I saw years and years ago, and just with all my travels, wasn't able to really kind of get with them again. And it was big, man. I'm not going to put a number on it, but it was my best striper for sure. It was a big one.
Well, y'all can see it on the cover of Fly Fishing Mag a couple months ago if you want to see it. But Blaine, tell them. Keep it real simple. Would you say this was incredible? And, you know, fishing right now for stripers, I'm laughing when I'm looking at your face. And what was it, if the answer to that is no, what was it like when it was incredible? Because me and you lived through that.
Yeah. I mean, I would, it's like hunting big fish in anything you're doing. I would relay what I was doing for that big striper and relate that to targeting muskies. So I went out knowing that the numbers are not big, but the sizes of them are huge. But so the payoff is big, but the time and effort put in, you're looking for the fish of 10,000 casts now, right? For me and what I was doing. That being said, moving the clock back early 2000s, the Chesapeake Bay was phenomenal. Even those giant fish that I was targeting last spring, prior to their spawn, actually super late winter, we used to be able to go do that all the time. I mean, there was big fish everywhere, not necessarily that 50-pound range plus, but, you know, a lot of 30s, 40-pounders, you know what I mean? I used to host trips when it got a little bit too cold. A lot of those fish would migrate just a little south to the Outer Banks. And I would fish with Brian and Sarah and host trips down there with clients for a week between Christmas and New Year's. And you would see acres of them. Acres. And that doesn't happen anymore. Every day in the Chesapeake, back late 90s, early 2000s, people were going out towards the bridge tunnel or whatever, and they would fish at night and target those big fish out there every night.
My gosh, in the light lines, Harry caught the 20-pound world record.
Yeah, that doesn't exist anymore. And if it is, nobody's talking about it. I mean, you know, we could go way into the bay on how all that stuff is, but, you know, going back into the, I don't know, fishing with Hank Norton when I started cutting my teeth in saltwater, which has been a long, long time ago, we'd go out in the fall, spring, whenever. And there'd be acres of schoolie size stripers that you could target on glass minnows or baby bunker or whatever. None of that's there anymore. I mean, there's bait around, but the fish aren't there. you know, and I know a lot of guides, it's not doing it anymore because it's not sustainable. And so, and they've switched off species until there's, you know, every species that gets switched off to, and we can go into that with the bay. Yeah, there's copia towers everywhere.
To go down.
Right. I mean, people have switched to what they're targeting because what they were targeting is not there anymore. Right. There's pockets, but you could go anywhere where there should be fish with pinch points and currents and whatever and be successful. Now you have to know exactly where the few fish that we still have around are. And I have friends that target them, but it's 25% or less of what it used to be.
Yeah. Jake, what are you seeing?
Well, to go back a few years, I'd say Long Island, the patterns took longer to crumble based on what I'm heard from guys in New England. But for the most part, it was really hard to not catch a schoolie. The number of times I felt guilty putting a 3 or 4-aught treble into a Hudson River fish that was maybe 18, 20 inches long was pretty tough to deal with sometimes. But overall, the drop off from the Hudson River recently has been exactly what I've heard from everyone in New England, where you used to have to work to avoid those fish to catch a big fish. And just like Blaine was talking about muskie, that involved going to places that weren't always as productive, where you might get a skunk and then another skunk and then another skunk just to run into that big fish that you're really looking for. And now that I've moved to Maine, that's all that's available. I don't have to bounce around to avoid 20% of the young of the year who are just going to keep tapping at my hoagie or my middle lip or my darter or these bigger plugs. Or like, I haven't caught a fish under 35 inches, and I'm now probably at 4-1 skunks. But when you run into that big pile of fish, I think there's something going on with the competition between them, where if they come in tight, they're there to eat. They're jacked up because they're not competing with schoolies. They're competing with who knows how many 40-50-inch fish.
So not incredible. Incredible moments,
yeah.
not an incredible fishery.
Yeah, and we were talking about that the other day, where there's a big difference between the quality of the fishing and the quality of the fishery, where for some new guy who hasn't gone out and realized, oh, well, I need to move now because I haven't caught a fish over 30 inches, and I want that 40-inch fish, all they have to do now is stand at a productive spot, grind it out, and they're going to run into the fish of a lifetime. And there's nothing wrong with that. Those are some of my favorite memories. I mean, I love the kid who's out there being like, I don't know what I'm doing, but I think it's going to happen tonight. I love running into those guys.
Yeah.
But yeah. The ability to pattern these fish is still there, but you have to be able to deal with a lot of holes as different waves of fish come and go. And it's just, you used to be able to learn from smaller fish and put together different patterns, but that just does not feel to be the case anymore.
So I'll throw my 2 cents in, because Blaine's a little south of me on the bay. But this used to be an incredible fishery. I mean, incredible, like you didn't even have to know what you were doing. And the size and the numbers of fish were unbelievable. It was just unbelievable. And we had a lot of other things to fish for as well. So we all knew, you know, if it was really, really hot, we didn't go striper fishing. We'd go catch Spanish or bluefish or something else, flounder fishing, whatever. But all that's gone. And if I told people what it was like back in the day, they wouldn't believe me. But I will just say, I can remember with, you know, Blaine's talking about, you know, the sitting off the third or fourth island at the Bay Bridge Tunnel and just looking around and looking north up into the bay and then looking south out into the ocean. And that you, I'm not joking. And Blaine will tell you this. You'd see 5,000 gannets. It looked like a cloud. Like when they were a mile or two away, it looked like a storm cloud moving. And on one end, they're hitting the water. And on the other end, it looks like a tornado. Yeah, you ever see like a 10,000 snow geese get off a field? They kind of look like a tornado as they gain altitude. And you'd watch the whole thing and you'd get excited and you'd be like, let's go that way. And you turn around and you're like, well, oh my gosh, they're there too. And then you look up and you're like, hey, we don't have to move. They're coming to us. And that was every day. The wind could be blowing. It could be slick calm. Didn't matter. You know, that was the fall run. We don't have a fall run anymore. So I had an issue with them saying it was incredible. So let's go on to the next. We're going to break this one apart. Let's go on to the next line. And I'm sure y'all are going to have a lot to say about this. So, oh gosh, darn it. Hold on. Y'all going to have to give me a second. I'm not even going to make Cody edit this. You know, Blaine pointed out something while I'm scrolling through my phone feverishly. Blaine pointed out something. So he said he used to run trips down in North Carolina. They just aren't there anymore. And you got to understand, they were there because they were leaving the bay and migrating down from the north. And they've like filled up the Bay Bridge. So they just go a little further south into North Carolina. And North Carolina had a biblically good, it wasn't a different population of fish. It's just that many of them. So they were spread out. And it's kind of wild to think about, like, that's how many fish we used to have. It could be going off in New Jersey and Cape Cod at the same time. Fishing could be good from southern New Jersey to North Carolina at the same time. And nobody seems to remember that. So I found this daggum thing. So next thing that we're going to talk about is the stripers are largely in New England for one reason. They're following large migratory schools of bayfish known as menhaden, also called bunker, that they depend on for food. So, Ray, you've been out on the water a lot recently.
Yeah.
You are in New England. You are a guide. What are the stripers eating?
They are definitely not eating menhaden or bunker or pogies or whatever you want to call them. You know, we have little pockets of them here and there. When I was a kid, they used to fill the harbors up around here. But now I'm targeting bass on schools of sand eels and, you know, fishing on the rips because these fish are chasing squid. You know, we're throwing crab flies in shallow water. You know, I have a unique situation by me where these fish kind of, you know, almost filter feed off of micro sand eels that are kind of spilling out because we get the sand eels coming into the estuaries and spawning early on. But I would say that, you know, targeting these fish on schools of menhaden is a thing of the past. Definitely did it when I was younger. And, you know, we'd go into harbors and there would be solid amounts of them in the harbors. They kind of get stuck in there. They show up in the spring. They get pinned in there, spend the summer milling around the harbor, and there were always bass on them. And then we'd run into situations where there were bigger schools in open water with bass on them again. But, you know, it happens here and there, and we do have some in the water. But, you know, planning a trip around bass on menhaden is definitely a thing of the past. And, you know, sand eels, squid, you know, using live mackerel if you're into bait.
So but, they're just pummeling squid right now, right, up by you.
Yeah, and, you know, again, it's
Mike Hogan's shaking his head up and down feverishly.
Doing a good job keeping my mouth shut, yeah, but I'm nodding my head.
Yeah, And, you know, like Mike kind of said, it's little pockets and little moments where the fishery is really good. And there are areas right now where the bass have kind of congregated on zones like rips where there's plenty of bait, plenty of squid, and the fishing's great to an extent. Calling it amazing is a stretch, but, you know, it's good. But how long that lasts is only as long as those fish are on that bait until the bait moves on and so do the fish. But, you know, just hearing that people think that bass are coming into New England following schools of menhaden is frustrating because that is not the case. I can tell you that flat out.
Mike, you seeing the same thing as Ray? Do you corroborate his
man? Yeah, strong... I'm like crawling out of my skin here. And so anecdotally, first of all, I've been out Ray's a professional captain. I'm a professional lure maker, so I'm hopefully out less than Ray because I need to make sure the lures are kept out. But I've been out a bunch. And so granted, my filter is on the sell side. So I don't know that I've seen, other than super early in the year, unmolested pogies, like real, real early in the year, I don't think I've seen a single pogey in all the little nooks and crannies. Granted, you know, I'm not looking for them because I don't expect them. Sort of, it's like a reinforcing loop there, you know, sort of given up on that. So anecdotally, no, I have not seen striped bass feeding on fogies. But what the insight that I have that maybe no one else has on this podcast is lure sales. So I can tell you pretty much what fish are feeding on at any given moment in the Northeast Corridor by lure sales. You know, a big percentage of e-commerce sales, big percentage of independent dealer sales, big percentage of big box stores, and they all sort of follow the same. So it's good data is what I'm trying to say. And historically, when the pogies around, it's, you'll say the big plugs, the big soft bass, that sort of stuff, the smaller, you know, so I can tell, you know, all that. So what's selling literally from Maine to New Jersey are squid patterns, literally soft plastic squids, amber color lures, you know, that sort of thing. Anything imitating a sand eel. Small stuff, not bunker stuff. And so our customer base tends to be artificial focused rather than a live bait crew, you know, say we sell lures. And but they're avid users. We have power users, we have all the data, and you know, our average angler fishes, embarrassed to say, probably more than I do these days. But it's crazy how little pogey, bunker, menhaden, depending where you're from, ask lures we're seeing in our data right now. And, you know, the proof is in the numbers for us. I'm a bit of a, you know, Tony will tell you, I'm a bit of a data nerd and look at all the data and stuff. So I don't really trust my own eyes, which I've, in fact, not seen pogies in my travels. But the data we have in the back end at Hoagie is pointing to what everyone here else has said on the cast: squid, sand eels, and lots of little stuff, crab patterns. We're seeing lots of, you know, little groundfish jigs being used for stripers, even crab imitations. So I couldn't agree with Ray more than what he just said, and I have data to show that.
Jake, what are you seeing out there in the surf, buddy? Are they solely, if you find the bunker, you find the bass, right?
Yeah, well, it might be the time for me to confess that I got a little toy skiff. So I'm not always in the surf in the middle of the night, but I have not seen any bunker and it's all a herring bite, even though there's plenty of little sand eels and other baits around. But reflecting on the time in Long Island has been interesting because 4 to 5 years ago was pretty much the peak of the bunker bite in early spring. And that would be Western Long Island, well into the Raritan Bay in New Jersey. But I think those fish were just easier to catch. And as that bunker population dropped off, and everybody has their theories, but I don't think it was the netters. I don't think it was just spring conditions, because a lot of those fish were still right on schedule doing exactly what they always did. And that's when squid started to move around. That's when tog were coming in tight. There was always plenty of other bait for them to eat at that point. And it's been interesting up here where I didn't know if I could really apply patterns, but like striped bass are just striped bass. And for me personally, if it swims or crawls or slithers, like if you get it in front of their face when they want to eat, they're going to eat it. And it might have been easier to pattern some of those fish down there on bunker to know, well, the wind's blowing this way, bunker are going to go to the protected shore, or they're going to have to all come out around this point when the water gets this level. Like at the same time, the fish are still where they all, the fish were still where they always were for me. And that's really played into how I fish up here. So I don't really care what's going on with bunker or bait. If I can find when a striper wants to eat, then I'm a happy camper.
Blaine, what were those big migratory fish eating when they were getting up into tributaries?
Gizzard shad. Yep.
Or herring, depending on the tributary.
Herring. Yep. And
there wasn't a single bunker in the bay. It was so too damn cold, wasn't it?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. The water temperature was like 42, 43 degrees. So, yeah, I mean, not giving away secrets on it, but you know, those fish are obviously, and I was going to talk about this too. I mean, that migration we're talking about, you know, like you could say, have the theory that they're following the bunker up there, but it's more temperature, man. Big fish, they like temperature and they follow the temperature. After they spawn here in the bay, they're going to start migrating. One, when they run into food, they're going to eat it generally, but they're migrating, their historic migration north, because water temperatures, they like comfortable water temperatures, you know? That's one thing. I mean, Dahlberg always talks to me. Every time I talk to him about a great fishing day or a tough fishing day, he's always like, what was the water temp? You know? And that matters. It's not always necessarily about them following menhaden up the coast or down the coast or whatever. They're following migration patterns based on water temperatures, salinity, or whatever it may be. The urge to spawn, you know, it's just like salmon. They go back to where they spawn. You know, that's where they were born. They know once they leave that area, they're going back up there. But, you know, and they run into bait, whether it's bunker, whether it's herring, whether, you know, whatever it may be, you know, they're going to eat it because it's in their way. They run into it, whatever it may be, you know, but, you know, I've seen big schools of bunker in places and they're like, why is there not a fish here eating it? Right. I mean, it's not always that. It's not always the case just because you have a lot of bait or of a certain species that fish are on it. You know, I've seen huge schools of bunker where, and then you can't see a fish on bunker, and then you go over a little bit and up a mile or down a mile or whatever, and there's little schools of glass minnow, and that's where they are. They're eating them. You know what I mean? A lot of times it's temperature, where they are, different, you know, whether it's the sun, and there's all kinds of things that we don't know. You could speculate on, and being a guide for years, I mean, that's what keeps you thinking and designing, and you know, what am I doing? Why am I here? You know, why are they here then? All that kind of stuff. Like they're in that warmer water in the spring pre-migration up to go spawn. They're staging there because it's a comfort zone. The water temperature is much warmer where they happen to be versus any other place. And they're staging there to be happy. And whatever food source might be in that area, that's what they're going to be eating at that time.
Yeah, Blaine, and I don't think people to the north understand, like, there's a lot of gizzard shad.
Yeah.
In the bay, and that is an oily, very protein-rich fish. and they will knock the britches off a gizzard shad. I think weren't we the ones talking about, or it was me and Jake. Why the hell do you think they made a glide bait like that? That's how gizzard shad swims when it's been knocked, when it's got the brakes beat off it. That's exact. It's just like, that's a gizzard shad, folks.
Yep. Yeah, it's the same thing in freshwater too. Landlocked stripers. I mean, a lot of these lakes that we fish, whether it's Tennessee, Virginia, or whatever, I mean, stripers are stripers. They don't know that they're not supposed to be in that lake. It's just where they are. But I mean, there's times where they key in on gizzard shad, you know? I mean, it's just, and there's tons of thread fins are out there, right? So why are they eating that when they could be eating more of these? It's probably got to do with their size, water temperature, size of the bait, you know? They elephants eat peanuts, right? So,
well, sometimes it's that
popcorn,
you know, with Ray and Mike and Jake, like they're the northern folks compared to us. Squid, it's weird. Like everyone in New England knows, you know, squid in the rips. That, you know, the stripers will key in it. Stripers will eat squid a million different ways. Big squid, little squid, microscopic squid, squid. You know, it's probably pretty darn easy for them to digest and swallow, too. It's probably a pretty easy meal. But we don't even think of that because we don't have that down here. Well, I saw a squid, I'd pass out. You know what I mean? Like, and it's for them, they see acres of them. And this year in particular, right, guys, it's been like a biblical squid year.
It's been a good squid year.
That's what I've heard. I don't know if I'm wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right on there. There's been more squid around this year than in previous. And you know, I would agree with Blaine 100% that water temperature is a huge driving force for these fish. I mean, they obviously, when they start to show up here, we're starting to see water temps in the high 40s, low 50s. And you're going to find your best fishing in upper estuaries and more active fish where that water temperature is a little bit higher on the mudflats and things like that. Around those marshy edges, not really in the open water early on. And then, you know, they follow that water temperature as it warms up in the bay and the bait becomes a little bit more active. But, you know, what I found kind of interesting this year is, you know, where I am, there's a lot of hickory shad around. And I found that a lot of these fish were holding up in the rivers longer than they have in the past. And I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, the high protein availability of river herring, but a lot of hickory shad as well. And whereas they could have been in the open water and the water temperatures were there, they were kind of just holding tight in these rivers, you know, big schools of them up on the flats. And, you know, we got them during the day because that's when most of my trips are, or early morning. But I can only assume that at night they're putting a beating on the hickory shad. And, you know, obviously river herring have always been a traditional bait for stripers, but, you know, water temp and bait. But I think that especially here in New England, we've seen a shift in the striped bass population from, you know, whereas it was more spread out years ago, because of abundance of fish, but now they're really following that water temperature as it has climbed over the years. And where I am on the south coast of Mass, we see higher water temperatures faster than we used to. And these fish don't hold around the Elizabeth Islands or the Vineyard in numbers like they used to. There's still fish there, but it's not where the biomass goes. The biomass goes up and around the Cape and holds up in Boston, New Hampshire, Maine. And those fish don't hold down here like they used to. And that's definitely water temperature.
And Ray, I just want to add to that. I mean, there's so much bait in coastal Massachusetts, you know, whether it's sand eels, silver, I mean, you can sound like the Bubba shrimp guy in Forrest Gump. And to your point, the temperatures have gone from, wow, it's a really cold season, to wow, it's a really hot season. There's that inflection point. The Cape is sort of an interesting nexus point. I use the right word. You have the cooler, the Labrador sort of water coming down to the Cape and the Gulf Stream. And so on the south side of the Cape is that warm and the north side is sort of cold. So there's like a big diversity of bait. And so these fish come, and I remember all growing up, and I remember pre-good striper days, I started fishing regularly saltwater in the 80s. So, I mean, I don't need to fill in that story, but there was a big chunk of my career in the Falmouth sort of ground zero where there was like no pokey. You just didn't see the pokies, whether the bluefish, it just wasn't. But there was always the migrations when it got good, and the fish would come, the fish would go, but the bait would, that was always interesting to me, was the fish with the bass, the stripers would move on, and there'd still be a ton of bait left. And so it wasn't, to me, I mean, that's anecdotal, but it reinforces that temperature phenomenon where, you know, these fish are moving for, you know, larger reasons than what's on the buffet line. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen striped bass leave bait to keep moving, and whatever it is, fill in the blank.
So I guess, you know, as we're going through this, my big thing with this podcast to talk about, you know, when we're seeing posts like this and what's actually happening out there, and y'all, you know, we pretty much cover the entire striper range, and we spend a good chunk of our lives on the water. So, you know, when you see a post like that, and I think most of y'all saw it, get you a little mad, because, you know, what this group has done over the past few years is say, well, the reason why there's no stripers, you know, the reason why the population is declining is because of menhaden. Yeah. Now, with all y'all's experience, do any of y'all buy into that? And our years in the fishery. So, you know, we got trying to, you know, some of the guys are a little bit younger than some of the other ones. Notice I didn't say we were older. But so that would, I'm just trying to add up right here. So we probably got, I'm guessing, I'm going to be nice, and I'm going to say we probably got 250 years of striper fishing on this podcast right now. Or 150 years of, sorry about that. I'm not quite that old. 100, and I'm not also not good at math, apparently. So 100, probably got 150 years of striper fishing. I'm probably being a little conservative.
It's a better number.
Yeah, I know, Mike, because we're in the latter half of that. But does anyone buy into that? Man, I'm
0%.
Not.
0%.
Yeah, Mike.
0%. Would buy into what? Like the
reason why the striped bass population is depressed is because of the reduction fishery in Virginia.
0%.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone,
y'all, if y'all can see this video, everyone like put their head back, took a deep breath, and then three people spoke at once. So Jake had the biggest expression on his face. So I'm gonna load him up, and then we're gonna go to Blaine, and then we're gonna go to Ray. 0% from Mike.
I think it just proves how little they understand about striped bass and the fishery as a whole, where we were just talking about baits, and every single time there's a little cloud of sand eels, there's something else, there's intermediate baits eating those baits. So even if they aren't on those glass minnows, I don't know what you guys would have for that down there, but there's going to be an eel, there's going to be mackerel, there's going to be pollock, there's going to be cunner, bergalls, tog, snapper, bluefish, like you name it. There's always going to be another intermediate bait acting as a predator that a striped bass will eat. And while all of those bait fish species might be not doing as well as I'd like them to be, but at the same time, I cannot buy that there's a bunker. I cannot buy that there's a striped bass out there that only eats bunker. It doesn't exist.
Blaine?
I agree 100%. I mean, there's so many different forage fish, and being in the fishing industry forever, I mean, there's a reason why we have crab patterns, whether you're fly or conventional, sand eels, glass minnows, you name it. I mean, there's so many different types of food that they can eat. But for me, the biggest problem is that there's a lot less fish in the system that are creating smaller fish. I mean, a prime example is, you know, and Tony, this helped support us, the Cheeky Tournament for years. They were calling it the Schoolie Tournament for a reason. And when you, I mean, starting 10, 12 years ago, you go up there and you did catch schoolies. Now in the past few years, that's not the case because there's no schoolies. So when you have less bigger fish producing smaller fish, that's the problem. I mean, it's not rocket science. I mean, that's all you ever see is how people talk about how epic the fishing is, because they haven't seen it when it's really epic. You know, they see glimpses of epic because there's nothing but bigger fish around. But the scary thing is when that's all you see and there's nothing else. That's the problem. And bunker has nothing to do with that. Zero.
So Ray, because I'm gonna go back, Blaine. As soon as Ray says his piece, I'm gonna go back and we're gonna have another Menhaden podcast. But I'm just gonna make one comment about the reduction fishery in Virginia. But that's gonna be after Ray says his piece. So Ray, do you think that there is a direct connection to the lack of Menhaden and the numbers of striped bass?
No. I mean, striped bass eat everything, you know. They'll eat sea robins, they'll eat fluke. You know, we've gone through the list of what they eat. And I think for a conservation organization to say something like that is irresponsible and doesn't help the state of the fishery or, you know, the push to help save the fishery. I think that it kind of makes people believe that there's a simple solution to this problem and that if we bring Menhaden back, then we're going to get stripers back. But it's not that simple. And there's way more factors to it. And we have a lack of fish in the system. We have a lack of recruitment. And there's environmental issues. There's predation issues. And there's a whole number of issues that matter far more than the lack of Menhaden in the system. You know, as mentioned before, when these fish bump into different prey items, they're going to eat them. And they don't need to rely on Menhaden. Obviously, it's a protein-rich source. But it's really frustrating because, you know, like Blaine said, people think this is epic fishing, and it's not, I can tell you. And all these young guys that are into fishing, I think it's great that there's a lot of young people getting into the fishing. And, you know, they have no idea what a good fishery looks like. I'll kind of leave it at that. But I just want to say that it's irresponsible to say something like that when we have so many other issues in this fishery. And there really needs to be a push to help people understand that they can do a part. You know, they can help this fishery by practicing catch and release and being a more responsible angler and helping keep more fish in the system so that we have a chance at a future fishery.
A rock solid answer, man. I appreciate that, Ray. And Blaine, I said I'd just circle back to you for a second. So me and Blaine probably live the closest to the reduction fishery out of anyone on this call. I don't think that's an accurate statement. And we've probably seen them out there more than anybody on this podcast. And, you know, they really don't get up going fishing until, you know, just before summer starts. That's when their season starts. Guess what else starts then? That's when we get the big redfish and cobia. And if there's any two fisheries that are, you know, in direct conflict and just nothing will ruin your day faster than seeing them blue boats coming, it's when you're on a school of big redfish or cobia. Because yep. Your day's over because you got to get out the way. So, and Blaine, I mean, how do you feel when you're, having a decent day cobia fishing, you look up and you see the bow of that boat pointed at you and there's a school of menhaden.
Oh, I mean, I've been out there many times and you see the spotter plane come over you and you're on a school of menhaden and cobia are all around it or big reds or whatever, and it doesn't take long. Even if you don't see that boat that day, the next day you go back out to that same area and they've already decimated it. It's gone. And you see them around. So yeah, there's a correlation with bait and the fish and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, but then, like now until fall, you know, the target species now down here is redfish and cobia. One, because there's not that many smaller fish. Like we said, there's pods of them and different things, but they're not out there in the main bay generally this time of year. They're, you know what I mean? They're going to be near estuaries and whatever. So my big thing is, you know, menhaden, they're important. They're very important. It's not that we're poo-pooing menhaden. Everything needs saving, right? But it's to what we're focusing on is to say that that's a root cause of striper decline is ridiculous. I mean, yeah, there's an argument saying if there's more bait, the predators are going to be healthier, and that's a very true statement. But there's other food sources that they feed on, you know.
Boy, you ever clean a fish back in the day from the Bay Bridge Tunnel? Because I will pull a Mike Hogan and go Forrest Gump, Bubba Gump shrimp on everyone.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I remember we kept one. Like, remember we used to launch it like Kip to Peak and get out there and, you know, God, be an hour wait at the ramp on a Tuesday. Stingrays out of business. They were, shoot, man, you're standing in the parking lot to get into stingrays and the food wasn't even that good. And, you know, every once in a while we keep one, just kind of cook in the parking lot kind of thing, you know? And, man, baby flounder, sand perch, which is kind of like a white trout. If y'all don't know it, that's not a white perch. We call it a sand perch. It's kind of like our version of a white trout. Mantis shrimp, bunker, eels. I saw red hake. Pulled a red hake out of one stunt. I mean, it's like the Serengeti, y'all. When that migration from north to south used to happen in the fall, if you think about it, all those predatory fish would just go boom. Okay, we're at Montauk. We're at that north end of Long Island because the water temperature's right. Boom. We're at the Hudson. Water temperature's right. All that bait's flushing out and the young fish are flushing out. Boom. We're at the mouth of Delaware Bay. Boom. We're at the mouth of Chesapeake Bay. And there's all, every single one of them places has different species of fish. Some of them have the same, some of them have slightly different. And it was the same. It was a larger biomass than the wildebeest migration in the Serengeti in its heyday. That is a scientific fact. And it was everything, huge bluefish, tuna, striper, is the whole enchilada just chugging their way down. And it's not like that anymore. And by no means are we defending the menhaden industry. As a matter of fact, I'll just say this. We got a meeting coming up in August, another one in November. They kick the can down the road just like they always do with the last one. And we're going to be informing everyone about those meetings and how you can actually really make a difference instead of kind of say a bullshit narrative to raise money. And I think that's why we're on this podcast, is because we got to get serious about striped bass. I'm not denying that there are a good chunk of big fish out there and people are being successful. And some people are catching the fish of a lifetime. But my question is to each one of y'all, how many little fish have you caught this year? And by little fish, how many fish under 30 inches? Under 27 inches, let's say, because 7 years of bad spawn, and that's about 27 inches. How many fish have you caught under 27 inches this year, guys?
can probably count on one hand, to be honest.
And Ray, 10 years ago, what would you have said if I asked you that question when you started your guiding business? If I said on July 1st, how many fish under 27 inches have you caught?
It would have been hundreds. It would have been hundreds, maybe more. That's Mike, how we used to start our season.
Yeah. Mike, what do you have? You got a long time fishing Cape Cod 10 years ago versus today. How many fish under 27 inches would you would have caught by July 1st, and how many have you caught this year?
It was infinite. I mean, I don't even have to quantify the old days. And so I remember I used to teach fly fishing classes, and it was amazing because talk about the ultimate onboard to folks to the sport. Yeah. We'd go down to West Falmouth Harbor and do the casting clinic on land for the first day. Everybody, I mean, these people had never touched a fly rod the day before, and we were waist deep in, the waders that we provided and everything, and everyone was catching fish, and it was a really good, so I'm meandering here with the warm memories, but it was a special time. And this year, I mean, it's funny, it almost feels like you're bragging, but I haven't caught a underslot fish this year, I don't think. And, they're all big. I mean, so it's cool that way, but it's someone that's near and dear to the sport. It's also alarming. And I wish I was as articulate as the other guys on this podcast, but it's come up a number of times, folks that are relatively new to the sport may not know what it could have been. They also don't know they don't know enough to see what the decline looks like. And so that's an important thing too, is if they start at a certain, the goalposts have been, preset for them going into it, but it's that change that's alarming to some of the, the white hair and gray hair folks, myself in that inclusion. And it's saddening and it's terrifying. And I think it was Ray that talked about the misinformation. And it's a huge disservice. Sorry, I'm on my soapbox here, but with the misinformation, some of the blame game, because it's deflecting, sleeves rolled up to do the right thing, whether it's, better rigging from tackle companies, better fish handling with it, all the things. And, fisheries management, all of it. But to answer, Tony, your question, I can't even say the two things in the same sentence. It doesn't feel right. But from infinite to zero, in my case.
Jake, especially since you have your my first skiff boat, and you're seeing, you've got.
I was just trying to think of how to describe my only schoolie this year does not count because I think technically it was in the Hudson Nursery, and it was maybe a 20-inch fish that ate the big dock, and that was the last time. That was the last time I fished that spot, but that night I went to one of the old standbys that I don't really fish that often, and that's where I ran into the kid that I mentioned earlier, where he couldn't have been more than 18, 19. I'd seen him a few years in a row. His dad would go out. They'd fish porgies and fluke in the summertime, and he was just out there grinding away. And if I didn't recognize him, I wouldn't have stuck to it, but it was perfect conditions, like wind in your face, really making the current rip around the point. And I'll admit it, I dropped a big fish and I was pissed at myself. And he somehow on a 9-foot rod and a 150 Van Stahl managed to finesse a 50-incher through the rocks, and I just felt so bad for him. Like that kid is ruined. He fishes enough where I know that he loves it, but at the same time, I don't know if he's going to get to have the fun that people of my generation did, where we had to learn from schoolies. And when you pulled a 30-incher out of a bunch of 20 to 25 inches, that was the best day you could have. And then that just moved up to 40-inch fish. And slowly, you just get into this cycle of loving the sport and loving the fish. And before you know it, you're fishing too late at night and you get a little micro skiff and you're hooked for life and you can't do anything about it. So I'd say, like, I'm really glad Mike just said that, because I'm really worried about the younger generations. Already they aren't fishing enough, but there's just something to the learning process that I think makes striped bass anglers as addicted and awesome as they are, where you can pattern the fish in a way that you can't pattern a lot of other fish. And because they eat more baits in more unique settings than any other fish I can think of, they are really special to the East Coast and the Northeast in particular.
Blaine, I don't even know if I should ask you, because I know you're not fishing for the little schoolies.
Dude, I made my career on that for years.
Yeah.
In the spring, going down to the migratory rivers and guiding for Roanoke Rapids, James River, stuff like that. Spent a couple weeks there while all the fish were coming up, and it was a schoolie fest. Catch thousands of them. I mean, throughout a sea. I mean, really, everybody, not just me and my boat, but I mean, we'd have times where it's like, I'd have clients that want to sit down and quit because they caught so many, and it's fleeting at most. I mean, there's still some that come up in these places because it pinch points so down, you know, everything kind of gets pushed into a smaller area, so you can't help but find them, but it's just nothing like it used to be. I mean, you'll go just where it was an all-day fishery, now it's like early morning, late evening kind of thing. A lot of that has to do with water levels and whatnot. You know, when you have a lot more fish, there's a lot more competition to eat what you're throwing out there. And that's a big part of it. But no, I mean, I haven't even gone to do it anymore in a couple of years now, because the reports I get from friends that are still doing it, it's not really worth me coming down to do it, because they know what I used to see. So,
yeah, I mean, that's, you just described the Susquehanna Flats for me.
Oh, yeah, I did that years ago. Yeah, I know. I hear you, man.
I mean, man, we stopped going. You know, it's weird. Like, we saw it on the decline, 2008, 2009, 2010. And I can't, I mean, my timeline's messed up, but, you know, they banned it when they banned fishing in April a couple of years ago. And a lot of good that did. But so let's say, I don't know, man. I don't even want to give a year or guess, but I think we gave up on it probably around like 2016. We stopped going. So, I mean, imagine going to a place for probably 18 years and it just being like, you know, hey man, spring's here. It's cold, but we're going.
Yep.
And the pain in the ass of trailing her in your boat, good God, from the Eastern Shore all the way up and around. Whew, man, that was a pain. But what you knew, all you needed there was decent water. Just so long as there wasn't a big runoff and the water was all muddy, you weren't going to do too good. But if you had decently clean water, you're going to catch a fish of your life. Every time you went, for like 15 to 18 years. Nobody goes anymore. I mean, you're not allowed to, but even when you were allowed to, like, it's not a fishery anymore. So that's a problem. So, you know, I hope everyone kind of learned a little bit. It's tough to kind of dissect what's on social media and what the reality is. And that's why I wanted to bring all these years of striper fishing onto this podcast. And I think everyone here does it a little bit different. You got guys from the Chesapeake, you got guys who surf or, you know, close shore. We got a guide, we got a lure manufacturer. And everyone's saying the same thing. And I got to give everyone a pat on the back for even coming on the podcast, because, you know, a lot of people don't want to be honest about it because they're worried about lure sales, or they're worried about, are people going to book me for my guide trip? And they don't want to say, hey, yeah.
Is some headboat captain at the next ASMFC meeting going to tell me that I have no idea what I'm doing and I've never fished for striped bass before?
How you feel about that, Ray, when they tell you that? I know you hear that up there.
We hear that a lot up here, and I think that's actually kind of rich that people have, you know, guys with generations of experience, decades of experience, have that perspective still, where they make these self-serving comments saying that the fishery's as good as it's been, and, you know, that we don't need to change any regulations and this and that. I think, you know, ignorance is bliss for those guys, because end of the day, what they're trying to do is preserve their way of life, their charter business or their commercial fishery or whatever it may be. So they're portraying this lie that the fishery is amazing and, you know, kidding themselves, whether they believe it or not. And that's the same stuff we're seeing on social media, where people are, you know, I see it from a lot of charter guys posting stuff and saying how epic the fishing is and how it's never been so good. But, you know, end of the day, they're a businessman, so they got to keep people coming through the door. And that's a good way to do it, especially in the state of a declining fishery. But I can tell you as a guide that I've never had to grind so hard to have a good day fishing. I've never put so many miles on my boat or burned so much fuel as I have to have a good day fishing versus 10, 15 years ago. So it's disheartening to hear people say that, especially the ones with decades of experience, because it's really self-serving and it's not helping.
Dude, I've seen it everywhere though, Ray.
Yeah.
I mean, Tony and us, we got all that in Louisiana when we were trying to do some redfish stuff down there.
Yeah.
But what it's just crazy how they do that. And I'll say this, you know, the business model that they have is archaic, right? Yeah. So the dock shots and basically your whole fishing experience with clients on how many fish pictures you take on the dock when you get back is not sustainable. And it's teaching people, I'm not against keeping a fish here and there, but catching your limit every day, wouldn't it be a whole lot? I guarantee if you took a poll of anglers that they would much rather be in fish all day long, catching fish all day long when they hire a charter, than to just catch your limit and leave. And that's it. Like true anglers, people that's going to return over and over and over. That you're not selling something that's sustainable anymore with all the, I mean, whether you could look at all of it. You could look at that the technology we have now, there's no place for fish to really hide anymore. I mean, we got all these things that are against all types of predators and prey.
Jake's head's going to explode. Blaine is literally preaching Jake's religion right now. I'm watching. God, we got to start doing the video, man. People would laugh. Like, everyone's kind of like uncomfortable in their chair. Yeah. Everyone's agreeing with Blaine.
Rocking, I mean, breaking their legs.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's true, man. Sorry to cut you off, but I just had to get that because I lose the train of thought pretty quick.
Oh, that's spot on. I think that couldn't be more true. And you know, it's not just the striped bass fishery, it's every fishery. And it's, you know, if you're not selling an experience right now and you're just selling a, you know, a limit to people, then you're doing it wrong.
And Tony mentioned, you know, the fact that, you know, may or may not be worried about lure sales or charter sales or whatever. I mean, you know, from an economics perspective, you could argue that's why I'm on here, because I'm worried about lure sales. And, you know, if I were managing for the quarter, sure, maybe I wouldn't be in my best interest to be here. But as someone that's thinking about Hoagie, say the CEO of Hoagie 100 years from now, you bet your ass I'm going to be on here, and you're going to bet your ass I'm you know, everywhere on the front lines where science matters and the truth matters and, you know, and just whatever the right thing is. And it's a complex problem. And that's the trouble with that podcast Tony read out. You know, it creates misinformation, deflection, just stalls the whole, the truth always comes out, but if it stalls the conversation, it stalls decisions. I mean, that's problematic. And, you know, it's a critical time. Sorry, I'm just kind of fired up, but doing a good job of keeping my mouth shut on this podcast. But, you know, it's just, you know, economically speak, any way you slice it, it's just time to, you know, look at this seriously. And, you know, are you managing, you know, define what we're talking about. And are we managing for what's the best in the next year and not worrying about the future? Are we worrying about the future? And it's just, there's so many conflicting, I'm a future person. I can't imagine running a business, getting the types of signals that we're getting and just saying, oh, screw it, I'm just going to keep going. In any way you slice it, running a small business or a large business, if you have these signals, any good CEO, CFO, COO, any leadership position whatsoever would put the brakes on and have like a deep dive into the situation. It's crazy to me anyway. You know, it's like people are looking for any signal they can to just, you know, cognitive biases, you know, confirmation. There's all the whole list. There's hundreds of them, but like they're just looking for reasons. Like, I see it's not a problem. I caught 40 stripers today. Could have been the last 40 of the 42 stripers out there. And people are basing facts on weird stuff and not right stuff. Or, you know, sure, maybe it was, you know, definitions are important. That's my takeaway here, because there's just too many signals to ignore, in my opinion.
Couldn't agree more. I'm right there with you. I mean, I have a fly company and, you know, fly sales are direct result of good or poor fishing. And I never have in my whole career tried to look right at my tip of my nose. I've always looked at the future and, you know, that's where designs come and, you know, fisheries are not getting easier. There's less fish. There's more people. There's all these different things. And having a business similar to yours, it's you know, it's our responsibility to call it out. I mean, to pretend like things are good is not going to help us in the long run.
100%.
I mean, it's period. It's simple. All this is super simple.
It is.
But nobody wants to ever have someone tell them what they want, what they can and can't do. They're afraid they're not going to get their rights back or whatever it may be. And I don't care what side of the political aisle you're on. It's ridiculous. It's like Lefty always used to say, common sense, not so common. And that's 1,000% true in life. And you see it more and more these days. And you're just like, scratch your head. It's like, what's going on here, man? There's no way that you could take any charter captain anywhere in our country and say that the fishing is better than it used to be. It's just not true. It's just, and for them to say that, it's just not true. I mean, there could be little pockets that are better due to whatever it might be, right? But it's just generally in a general term, and I travel all the time, all year long, and fish all over our country. And there's not a single place I go that's not having some kind of problem, period.
Yeah, and I mean, look how that mindset where people are saying how good it is now has already stalled striped bass management last fall. I mean, in particular, that was a great example. There was so much outroar on social media and stuff about, oh, we don't need to do anything, you know, status quo. We don't need to implement any changes because it's the best fishing I've seen, and how that stalled any sort of progress we could have made at a pretty critical time. And I mean, you guys are a business. I have a guide business, and, you know, being on that side of the more conservation-minded side of things isn't always the most popular opinion, and not letting clients keep a striper when they come into a trip thinking maybe they can take a fish home isn't the most popular opinion, but it's that long view that matters, especially in a fishery.
Yeah, when I was flailing my arms around laughing earlier, I was thinking about how much this actually parallels bluefish And it's just, I miss good bluefish fishing as much as I know I'll miss solid striped bass fishing. And this, cut that, Tony. Are we talking specifically about the organization, or do I just say them? Okay. The people putting these ideas out there are the same ones who are lobbying for certain user groups to keep more bluefish, and they're the same ones that don't support striped bass conservation. And all that's on the public record in their public comments. So their motivations for pulling on striper anglers' heartstrings over whatever memories they have of awesome bluefish blitzes, like, well, bluefish and striper blitzes, it points to how shallow their motivations are and how little they actually care about these fisheries.
Wow.
I agree.
Boy, wasn't that the truth, what Jake just said.
Well, but
I was livid earlier, man.
We all are.
Somebody just dropped the mic somewhere. Wow. Well, you know, so just as a look ahead, kind of what's coming on the podcast is tomorrow night, we're going to have a group of redfish guys from both coasts talking about what's going on with redfish, because that is another fish that they're blaming the decline of on menhaden fishery. And I'll give you a spoiler. I don't know. We hadn't taped the podcast yet, but a spoiler alert. If you think a striper is a garbage can, I have pictures of slot redfish with Mardi Gras beads going in their mouth and out their butt. The same strand of Mardi Gras beads. Caught redfish with skate spikes, you know, little tail spikes sticking out of their head, you know, thrown up stuff that you're like, I don't even know what that is. So the redfish podcast should be a pretty good one. And then sometime after the holiday, we're going to hop on and probably do a menhaden podcast that's just telling y'all what's going on in the menhaden stock assessment calls and what we're looking at here in the future. And I'll just do a spoiler alert for that. You know, just remember, they messed up the natural mortality number, which meant there was a lot less menhaden in the system. We were supposed to take a 50% reduction. But, you know, Massachusetts, Maine, and Virginia harvest a lot of menhaden, and they didn't want to take a reduction. And so we ended up with a 20% reduction. But guess what? They weren't catching their quota anyway. Like 77% of the quota was caught. So if you take a 20% reduction and you're only catching 77%, guess what? You can catch 3% more this year than you did last year with that 20% reduction. You know, it's just, all it is it's just BS on top of BS. But we think we can make a difference with menhaden. So I want to thank Ray, Blaine, Mike, Jake, everybody. I think this was a pretty poignant podcast. I appreciate everyone's honesty and your knowledge about striped bass, and look forward to seeing y'all on the podcast here real soon.
Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Tony, guys, for having us.
Appreciate it, guys.
Good seeing you guys. See you out there.
Have a good night.